Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, I'm Cristina Mitre, journalist and author of the Beauty Mail blog. Welcome to my podcast, where every week I will chat with top experts in health and wellness so we can learn together how to thrive and enjoy a better life. After more than 20 years dedicated to psychotherapy and having sold hundreds of thousands of copies of her manual, The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read, Philippa Perry returns to bookstores with another manual that's more than recommended reading. The book you want everyone you love to read, and maybe a few you don't, she clarifies in the title. Her aim is ambitious: to help us become more balanced and happy people by improving the relationships we have with those around us, such as our partner, family, friends, co-workers, and even more importantly, by improving our relationship with ourselves. Today, in this episode recorded in English and also available translated into Spanish, Philippa is going to give us some advice to face those big questions about life that we all ask ourselves sometimes. How do you make the relationship with your partner last? How do you handle conflict effectively? How do you deal with your discomfort or difficult parents? How can you, in short, improve your relationship with others? Philippa is going to try and make us all a little happier by helping to solve all this house. Philippa Perry, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you very much, Christina.
Very nice seeing you. You're all the way in the UK. I'm here based in Dubai. So great connection. Oh, wow. Let's see. Fingers crossed. Because the starting of the interview hasn't been that smooth. Philippa, you say that this book, the book you want everyone you love to read, is a culmination of many of the answers to questions that people have come to you over the years. So regarding how to find and keep relationships, which is the most common question?
You know, I don't really have a most common question. All questions, you know, are from individuals, and they all come at them from sort of individual sort of ways. And the problem they present with might not be the problem they've got. For example, somebody might say, you know, why does my husband, you know, he said at the beginning of our relationship that, you know, he was going to share the chores, but why has he reverted to type and he never does it? So people always ask me why this, why that? And I think a more interesting question to ask ourselves is how? How did this arise? How are we managing our relationship? Rather than why is he like this? That doesn't really help us, does it? If we go, why am I like this? Why do I do this? Why do I always end up like this? Because then we just come up with a story that is probably not anywhere near the truth. So for instance, if somebody writes to me and says, you know, why do all my relationships end after 2 months? And I think a more interesting question to ask is, how are you organizing yourself so that your relationships end after 2 months? You know, what is it in your patterns of behavior that might be contributing to this problem? So I usually tweak the questions a bit, because when you ask how instead of why, you're giving the person who's writing to you a bit more agency. Because if they know how they're doing something, then they have the choice of whether to change it or not. The most common problem, now I'm not going to answer the question, the most common problem is, as you can see, my cat has come to join us.
Yeah, my cat is there too, so don't worry. We've got a party of cats. Oh, too cute.
Will you sit down, please? Thank you. He's now sitting. He's now sitting quite well, quite behaving. That's good. I've completely lost my thread.
No, you were saying that you were going to ask, which is the most common question you get asked.
Yeah. The most common question I get asked is why? And I change it to how. That is the short answer.
That's good. You say that when someone has a personal problem, if you go a little bit below the surface, you will find that the personal problem are usually relational problems. Where do we normally fail?
Why do we normally fail?
Or where? Where do we normally fail?
Where do we normally fail? When we're not normal at all, we all fail in our own torturous ways. you're looking for a sort of common thread. You're looking for the normal, and there ain't one. So, no, doesn't work, that line of questioning. Sorry. Where do we normally fail? I think a common failing, I wouldn't say it was the normal one, but a common one is we assume that when somebody does something or says something, it means the same as it would if we said it or did it. Yeah. We assume people's motivations is the same as what our motivation should be. Another failing we have is we can't bear not knowing. And so if there's gaps missing in the story, we use our imagination to fill them in. I'm very much enjoying watching a television program at the moment called The Traitors, which is a sort of like a murder mystery game, a reality TV game played out on television. And marvelous production values, but that's beside the point. And people have got to guess who the murderers are, who the traitors are. And they don't know, but it seems that humans, I don't say that I'm any different, but it seems that human beings can't bear staying with "I don't know." They always come up with a theory. And then if two or three of them come up with the same theory, they think it's the truth. And it isn't. And we can see this on the television because we know who the murderers are. And so we can just see, don't we get things wrong a lot of the time? Yeah. And this is what we do. We can't bear not knowing, so we fill in the gaps. And maybe we should learn to tolerate our not knowing a little bit more.
You say that connect with others is the most important part of our lives, that we crave connection. But, for example, in the UK, there's a minister for loneliness. Mm-hmm. Where are the challenges? How do we reconnect? Because we are really disconnect because of the internet and social media.
Yeah, that's true. It's too easy, isn't it, to have a sort of phony feeling of connection via someone liking our Instagram post. And it's a dopamine hit, but it's not a very deep or lasting or meaningful one. And I think it's because it's so easy. We're going to our screens rather than going to our neighbours. People used to talk on trains and they don't anymore. They just look at their phones. And I'm as guilty as anyone. I prefer to look at my phone, I think, than talk about the weather with a stranger. But I think in the long term, talking about the weather with a stranger is actually more satisfying than clicks and likes and I agree, I disagree, someone on the internet is wrong, let me just put them right. This is not proper connection or proper contact. We grow up, we're born sort of unable really to connect, but with a strong biological need and urge to connect. And if all's well, our parents have a strong need to connect with us as well when we're born. So we make that sort of initial bond. It takes quite a long time. It takes about, I mean, some people feel an instant bond, but that's like falling in love. But a real sort of bond with a baby sort of takes about 6 to 8 weeks of sort of getting to know each other and the baby getting to know the mum and or the main carer. And we then form in relationship. I mean, from the moment we're born, we're forming in relationship with another person. You know, we learn to talk, we copy their gestures and stuff, and we sort of soak up the culture of the family. Now, we might think, okay, so that's how we form. So surely, you know, once we're about 5 or 6, we're fully formed. We're not. We carry on forming in relationship all our lives. And although our need to do so is not as urgent as it is in a baby, it is nevertheless necessary to feel okay, to interact, be influenced by and influence other human beings on a daily basis, I think.
Talking about the internet, you also talk in the book about online dating, and that can be quite challenging. You say that one of the mistakes you see people making is that they treat online dating like shopping.
Yeah.
Could you please elaborate on that and give us any other tips?
There is a psychologist called Barry Schwartz, and he wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice. And he reported on some of his experiments he did in this book. One of them is he gives the control group a box of 6 chocolates and says they have to eat one and then choose one, eat one, and then report on their experience. The other group has got 140 chocolates to choose from. You know, they both come with a little key so you can see whether you want hazelnut cluster or Brazil nut or coffee cream or whatever you want. And so the people that had 6 chocolates to choose from chose relatively quickly and on the whole said they were very satisfied with their choice. The people who had 140 chocolates took a lot longer to choose. They didn't just go down the list and go, oh, number 3 looks good, I'll go for that. No, no, they wanted to look at the whole 140 chocolates. And then when they chose a chocolate, they were less satisfied with it. And the reason for this was they were thinking, oh, maybe I should have had the hazelnut cluster and not the Brazil nut. You know, maybe I chose wrong. And so it is with dating. Now we've got internet dating. We've got an infinite number of people to choose from. So, of course, we want to see them all, like we want to look at all the chocolates. We're not just going to go, that'll do, with the, you know, the first one you think you might be able to eat comes along. No. And Barry Schwartz also identified 2 sorts of people, the sort of people that say, that'll do, and the other sort of people that look for perfection. And guess which sort of people are happier? That's right. It's the that'll doers. It's not the perfectionists because they never find what they want. Now, in the olden days, we all knew about 140 people and that was it. And out of those 140 people, 3 might have been eligible. And out of those 3, 1 might have liked you too. So, you know, the choice was very limited.
Yeah.
When we went, that'll do. That's my coffee cream. That'll do. And then what you do, you commit when you're in that relationship. You commit to make it work. And it's the commitment that makes a relationship work. And then you become perfect for each other because of this mutual influence I talked about, because we form in relationship with other people. So we form in relationship with our partners quite a lot. And that mutual influence, that makes us good for each other. That you know, knocks the corners off each other so that we fit together and we make a good partnership. Now, if we go into it thinking, I'm going to find Miss or Mr. Perfect, for a start, we're going through the 140 chocolates, or how many, thousands of chocolates on the internet, aren't there? And then when we've got one, we think, maybe I should have gone for the other one. So you haven't got this commitment. And without commitment, you can't make a relationship work, because as soon as there's the problem, you're like, I'm off to get another chocolate. I'm going to spit this one out and try another one. You're never going to have a satisfying chocolate. And it's not because of the people out there. It's because of our attitude to each other, that we're looking for perfection rather than that'll do. When internet dating came about, my husband and I said to each other, oh, what a shame we never got to play that. It looks fun, doesn't it? But actually, I think we were wrong, because when we were looking to settle down, each of us, we met in the normal way, like I think it was through an evening class. And, you know, there was 10 other people in the evening class. I went out with all of them and I ended up with my husband. And, you know, we've been together for 35 years, committed and making it work. Yeah. And that's how it works. Sorry, I was just watching the cat. that's how it works. It works through commitment. And it works through mutual influence. It doesn't work with the shopping mentality of looking for the perfect black trousers.
And there are two other things to make it work that I'm going to ask you, because you explain in the book that Aristophanes, in his account of the origins of love, imagine that humans are cut in half by the gods and everyone has the perfect other half out there. But we know that there's not a perfect match.
Stop it. You ruined many lives. So you go around the whole world looking for your perfect other half. And in the end, you just have to pick on someone and go, that'll do. And they'll become perfect when you rub off against each other, when you get to know each other, when you get to understand each other's humour, when you learn how you fit together. That's what makes it perfect.
Yeah. You say that there are three things that can help. One is the commitment, and you have already guided us through that. There's also taking responsibility for your own feelings. And
not blaming the other person for your own feelings the whole time. I mean, quite often when we're in a bad mood or we're depressed, we look around and blame the nearest thing to us, which is usually our spouse, which is kind of unfair. So then we get divorced and then you think, oh, no, I still feel like that. Damn, it wasn't him after all. Yeah, so that's one to watch out for. I'm not saying that we don't affect each other and make each other feel things. What I'm saying is, don't make your partner responsible for what your default mood is, because you were probably, you know, that's probably something you were born with and you need to work on. The other thing is what a researcher called John Gottman found was that he observed couples in lots of situations. And he did longitudinal studies. And what he found is that if a couple, if they honor 7 out of 10 bids for attention, they're likely to be in a happy marriage or a happy partnership. If they honor less than 3, they're likely to be a bit of a disaster relationship. And by a bid for attention, it could be like, you know, you're reading the newspaper and your partner says to you, oh, look, a squirrel out of the window. And honouring the bid for attention, we go, oh, yes, a squirrel, rather than going, I'm reading, or ignoring them. So it's sort of when somebody wants attention by sort of going, oh, is it cold today? Or shall we make love? You know, those two things are quite close, actually. They're both asking for attention. And I'm not saying you have to honour 7 out of 10 bids for demands for sex, but 7 out of 10 bids for attention. Now, sex is another thing people get hung up about when it comes to relationships. They think, you know, is good regular sex essential for a long-term partnership? What is essential for a long-term partnership is loving touch, not necessarily sex, but loving touch. If you have loads and loads of sex and no loving touch, your relationship might be in trouble. But if you have frequent loving touch, but maybe infrequent sex, your relationship will be all right, because it's loving touch that we really need. That is a sort of sign of connection and togetherness. Whereas sex, John Gottman, again, his research has, he's found that regular sex is not necessarily an indicator of a successful relationship, whereas regular loving touch is.
You explain in the book that our society is organized around this idea of finding the one. And you wonder in the book if happiness is more easily found in groups. Do you think we should talk more about, for example, free male friendship? This is something I have discussed in this podcast with the writer Dolly Alderton.
All right. I like Dolly. She and I are friends. See? Friendship. Why are we friends? Well, we're both writers. We both meet in similar places, you know, so we're in similar groups. And we both have an agony aunt column and we both write books. She's a sort of writer and a thinker. I'm a writer and a psychotherapist. She's like young enough to be my granddaughter, but you know, that sort of thing doesn't really matter. Last time we bumped into each other was we were both having breakfast in a rather nice hotel with different people, and we bumped into each other on the way out. We're very pleased to see each other. Hello! That's one form of friendship. I'd say Dolly and I are in a group of, say, 140 people. So, you know, she's one of my top 140 friends. But friendships go down in different layers. Your first layer of friendship is your most intimate friends. You probably have two or three of those. If you've got a partner, one of them will be your partner, probably. Not if he's having an affair, then he won't be an intimate friend. But you have two or three, you might have a best friend and a partner. Men usually just have one, which is just their partner. They don't have this very close female friendship thing with a male that often. They do, but not as often as we do. And then there's the next circle, including the intimates, is about six people. These are your go-to friends in times of trouble. And then most people have a friendship group of about 12 or 14. So if you're thinking, who should we invite to the party? These people are at the top of the list. Then you've got a group, it goes much bigger then, a group of about 50 of about their family and colleagues, and include the inner groups as well. And then after that, it goes to 140. And then after that, it goes, those are people that, you know, you might invite to a big party. And then after that, it goes to 1,200, I think it is. This is the final number. And those are the people that you might recognize. You might not even know their names, but they might recognize. And that might include very unequal relationships, like you might recognize a celebrity who wouldn't know who you were, things like that. So that goes up to about 1,200. We haven't really got the capacity for many more names after that or faces. It's good to know these structures of friendship, rather than just sort of like think of them of just we all know them, but if unless you mention them, you don't sort of know them overtly, because sometimes you might think of someone in your circle of 12, and yet you might be in their circle of 50. Because they might be like super connectors and know a lot of people. And don't take that personally. It's just that they've made more contacts than you. It doesn't mean to say that they like you any less. And it's good to know these things when we're navigating friendships. And the other thing is there's a lot of fluidity between the circles. So suppose Dolly and I were put by our newspapers onto the same project that we were working together, we'd suddenly be in a sort of circle of 12, you know, in our 12 circle, because, you know, circumstances would have thrown us together. But, you know, when you're working with a team, like sometimes I make a documentary on television or on the radio, and I'm working with these people for 3 weeks, and they're the only people I see for 3 weeks. They become my best friends. And then afterwards, we dissipate. I was making some television the other day. I was on a quiz show called House of Games, and I was traveling back with a comedian that was on the same show as me, and I was talking about this, and he went, "That explains it," because he's saying, "I'm always working in these sort of close-knit groups with people, and, you know, we're working on the same TV show or something, and then the TV show ends and then we all go our separate ways." And he goes, "Hi guys, are we meeting up for a drink? What's going on?" Because he doesn't realize that that group is sort of over and he's sort of still moving at it. So when I explained this to him, he went, Oh, I get it. Not that they're rejecting me. It's just that their 12 is now full with another group of colleagues or whatever it is. And so it's really good to know these things when we're navigating friendship. And sometimes one person in a friendship changes. I mean, one of the most common changes is not necessarily when two best friends, one of them gets married, but if two best friends, one of them has children and the other one doesn't, then the one with children and the one without children have less in common. And many friendships sort of go from being in the circle of two or three into being in the circle of 50 after that. But it doesn't mean to say that when the parent is less sort of like taken over by children, that they won't get back together as being very close friends again. I thought of it once when I had a young child. I thought, I'm in this sort of baby jail. My friends are off doing what we always do, but I'm in this sort of baby jail. And I've got a feeling when I'm out of baby jail, we'll be back to normal again. And we were. So there is that sort of thing that happens. And I notice when my friends, me and my younger friends have a baby, they sort of go, they're not as sociable as they were before. I've got a friend actually who had a baby aged 51, which is amazing and wonderful. But we haven't been invited round to dinner since then. It's just got hands full, you know.
Pretty busy.
Personally, it's just how these things move around, you know. Friendships are fluid.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And female friendship is different from male friendship? Because you were saying at the beginning that normally we have like three very close friends and normally they have just like...
I'm generalizing hugely, but males have different ways of connection. We tend to connect by talking about our thoughts and feelings. They tend to connect with games. They play games. I don't mean actual chess, although that might be it, but they sort of play banter games of one-upmanship, but they're still close and they still have that connection, but they go at it sideways rather than face on. So they have different sorts of connections. Mm-hmm. And that's why their best friend is usually their partner, because that's the only person they talk to in that close way, whereas their other best mate might be the person they go cycling with or the person they go to football with. It's more of a doing thing than a just being together thing. I mean, they do learn through their wives and girlfriends, and I think gay men are different as well, because they have a lot of female friends, gay men. They do talk about more emotional and psychological process type things than men do in their football clubs and their drinking clubs of banter. And I quite enjoy banter when I'm with male friends and it's joshing and bantering. It's a different way of connecting and I really enjoy it, but it's just different.
When we talk about relationships, we have to talk about the way we argue. So there are a couple of questions I want to put to you. Philippa, how to have an argument without losing your temper, especially with your partner? I have to say that this question is for personal use.
You let go of the I'm right, you're wrong game. That's really important to let that go. And you put onto one side dealing with facts and you deal more with feelings. And you don't aim to win, you aim to understand and be understood. That's not the same as winning. So forget winning and losing, forget right and wrong. Aim for mutual understanding and aim for an understanding of the feelings, even if they're being presented with facts, if you're being presented with facts. Do you want more?
I take pretty good note. Why arguments about the smallest things and most insignificant can end up turning into a very heated situations?
It's because you don't feel seen. You're not arguing about whether it's right to put the kettle on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of the kitchen. You're arguing about, I have feelings about this and you're disregarding them, and that's very hurtful. But you're not actually saying that. You're going, the kettle goes there. Why do you just, it doesn't make sense to put it on the other side of the kitchen. It means you have to walk 3 steps further. Yes, but it looks better there. I mean, doesn't really matter where the kettle is, does it? What matters is, oh, you really want the kettle over there because it looks cute. And you know what? If you think it looks cute there, I can do the 3 extra steps from the tap because, yeah, it does look cute. It kind of balances out the window. Okay, fine. Or, oh, you're always in such a hurry and 3 extra steps in the morning, you feel like it's really holding you back. Okay, we'll move the kettle to where you want it. It's about considering each other's feelings. And there isn't a right place to put the kettle. So don't get right and wrong, good and bad about it. It's about considering each other's feelings and talking about it.
But sometimes it's not what you say, it's how you say it, because words matter. Why do we have to be so careful with the words we choose? Could you please give us some examples?
You do have to be careful with the words you choose. I think you have to be careful with each other's feelings. That's it. and if you are careful with each other's feelings, then maybe the words will make a difference. And it's also good to have a bit of a laugh about things like this, about when we're being ridiculous. We need to be able to laugh about ourselves. I just need to delete this phone call that's coming into me.
Oh, don't worry.
There we go. Sorry, I can't talk right now. Love it. It's already written for me by the telephone company.
Philippe? Which is the right way to deal with anger?
Oh, you're thinking there's a right way to deal with anger. Anger is a wonderful emotion. It gets things done. It's like a power force, beautiful thing. But it shouldn't really be used to crush another person. Anger is good when you just begin to feel it. Mm-hmm. And it probably means you need to put a boundary down. So for me, when my agent is going, oh, look, you can do 4 podcasts in the morning, 3 interviews in the afternoon, and then can you give a talk in the evening? No. The first small brick of anger is the word no. No, that's not going to happen. You need to put your boundaries down. And so you listen to your anger. So suppose I didn't put the no down and felt obliged to do all that work. I'd probably start shouting at her. And that would be horrible. Why did you do this to me? Horrible, horrible, horrible. Much better to go, no. So you have to be brave and you have to be seen as maybe not the nicest, most cooperative person in the world. Difficult for women sometimes. And you have to go, no, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to do that.
Why do we find it more difficult?
Because I think we're not trained to put a bound. We need to put boundaries down before our limit. Our limit is when we lose our temper. What we need to do is put a boundary down before we get to there. And we need to slow everything down so we don't get to the limit really, really quickly. So we need to learn how to manage ourselves. And for instance, with children, suppose their noise is getting on your nerves, but you tell yourself, it's their playtime. They're supposed to be having a nice time now. I'm being ridiculous. And then you'll shout at them later because you've just reached your limit. So it's much better to go, oh, I'm glad you're having such a lovely time. I wonder if you could have a quieter, lovely time because I'm finding the noise a bit much. Or when the kids really enjoy themselves at the playground and you're freezing and you want to go home, you go 5 minutes more and then we're going home because I'm cold and tired. You don't go, you've had enough now. All sweet. And they go, no, we haven't, mummy. So you put your boundary down before you reach your limit, even as though you feel like you're a pretty bad person for doing it. But you'll be a much worse person if you don't put your boundary down, you reach your limit and you lose your temper. Put your boundary down before you lose your temper.
And how do we navigate? In that case, how do we navigate conflicts with, for example, our in-laws?
Your in-laws?
Yeah.
You say, when you pop round without ringing me first, doesn't really work for me. Could you please give me a ring so that I won't be in my knickers when I answer the door? I'd appreciate that. Thank you. And they give you a ring and you go, oh, it's not convenient right now. I'm doing some work. A week on Tuesday would work fine for me. Boundaries. Same thing. It's boundaries.
Yeah, you say that is the same thing with co-workers, with your in-laws, with the spouses, best friend, grandchildren.
You lose your temper or you implode when you don't put a boundary down. Now, I live on a garden square, which is very nice. I overlook trees. It's very lovely. And sometimes boys, late at night, break into the square after it's locked and then run around and let off fireworks and make a general noise. As soon as I hear it, I go, right, I'm going out there. I go out there and I go, lads, you're having a great time and I'm going to spoil it. I'm afraid it's late and everybody around here has to work. So you're going to have to go home. Sorry about that. And they're usually quite sweet about it. My husband, on the other hand, if he's there and I'm not there, he'll go until he's sort of like eaten up. He'll never go out and shout at them because he thinks that a man going out and talking to the boys, he'll get attacked or something. Well, he might do. I don't know. I'd ever worry about it, and no one's ever attacked me. But, I mean, sometimes they are very drunk. But they're usually really good about moving on. I say the park over there isn't so close to houses. Go that way. but he will implode. It will just eat him up. The adrenaline of having a horrible time with the boys will eat him up. But I just go out there and go, not tonight. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you also say that if you need something to be done by someone, give them a bit of choice. but not too much.
Yeah. So you either shut up or you go to that park over there, not here anymore. Yeah. yeah. If your child has got to clean their teeth. So you don't say clean your teeth. You say, do you want the pink toothbrush or the blue toothbrush? Give them a bit of choice. And it works if you're doing the same thing at work. Do you want to do the report first and then the stats? Or do you want to do the stats first and then the report? I need them both by 5.
You choose.
You choose. Yeah. I mean, I'm the same. If somebody gives me a choice, I feel so much better. If my editor was to say, you have to do that problem this week, I'd feel a bit pushed into a corner. But if he said, you can do that problem or this problem, I go, oh, thank you. I'll do this one.
Philippa, how do we relate to those people that are conflict avoidant?
Oh, that's very difficult. If you're conflict avoidant because you're frightened, it basically comes from low self-esteem conflict avoidance, because you feel like if you say anything that might rock the boat a little, you'll get rejected. So these people are conflict avoidant, and that makes them really annoying because you never know what they want. Where should we go to eat? Oh, I don't mind. You choose. Well, what do you like? I like anything. Right, we'll go to Chinese then. You're not eating. No, I don't really like Chinese food. Makes me furious. How do we deal with them? It's very difficult, and it's very difficult for them because they feel like if they say what they want or if they say something's not working for them, they'll get rejected. The worst thing was when my father was sort of getting very frail, he never wanted to ask for help. This wasn't conflict avoidance so much as it's a very similar thing. Don't want to be any trouble. And so, you know, he wouldn't be any trouble, but he'd fall down because a handrail hadn't been put up or something. It would have been so much less trouble for us if we realized that we needed to put a handrail up. If he could just take a bit of trouble, like if he could say, I need my meals prepared for me. That's so much better than finding that he hasn't eaten anything but baked beans for a week, you know, which makes you feel awful because you didn't know. So if people can't make themselves vulnerable enough to ask for help, it's a real problem for the other person. You just have to spell it out. I want to know. But, you know, they still might not. And if someone is conflict avoidant, what will happen is they'll go, yes, 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 that's fine. Yes, 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 yes. And then they'll make themselves ill because they're doing what their body doesn't want to do. Mm-hmm. It's really annoying. I mean, I'm all for not sweating the small stuff. But you've got to know what your limit is, and you know what you do have to sweat, because otherwise it will. And the other thing is about if you've got two conflict avoidant people together, what happens is as they're not coming up to each other's boundary because they're just pussyfooting around each other, they'll lack intimacy. Because if you don't say who you are and what you want, you're going to start to feel a bit lonely with it. And if you're feeling lonely, say you're in a partnership, a loving romantic partnership with two people and they're both conflict avoidant. If you can't say what's wrong or what you want to happen differently in that relationship or what you need in that relationship, you'll begin to feel lonely in it. And if you're conflict avoidant, the way you might solve that loneliness is by finding a lover outside the partnership, which means that your original partnership breaks up, which might lead to conflict. Ache. And then you'll be in your new partnership and you'll be doing exactly the same thing. It'll be grim. Mm-hmm. So the trouble is with conflict avoidance, it's also intimacy avoidance.
quite right. You say in the book that being right is overrated. I really like that.
Yeah, I mean,
that's something that we need to take note.
That argument I was imagining with where to put the kettle in the kitchen. There is no right about that. So don't use logic to try and pretend there is. Look for the feelings underneath what people want to be right about.
You say in the book that cutting ties is rarely as destructive as many of us imagine, and in some cases, it might be the best path forward. But what happens if the problem is with your father or your mother?
Well, people do get divorced from their parents. I mean, only if they are very, very self-centered and cruel, usually. But if they are, people do cut ties with their parents, and sometimes it's the best thing for them to do for their own mental health.
Yeah, because sometimes we try to work it out, but it won't work.
It won't work if the parent can only see their adult children as extensions of themselves and not individuals in their own right. And under a regime like that, it's difficult for the adult child to thrive. You know, you want adult to adult relationships with your parents when you're an adult. Some parents are quite cruel, and they keep sort of power over their children with money and stuff. You've just got to decide how important the money is. Freedom might be more important.
You've got a piece of advice that I've never heard before regarding breakups or any other life changes. You say that it's important to open the tap and let the feelings out. And you even recommend to set a timetable for it, like weeping, mourning, or whatever, every day at the same time.
This is about obsession. This is my cure for when you have got obsessive thoughts, okay? And if someone's got obsessive thoughts and they think about them the whole time, to gain control over them, you put a timer on them. So you're only allowed to think obsessively about your ex between 5 and 5:30 every day. And then I also insist that you do think about your ex between 5 and 5:30 every day. And my cure for when your mind goes to your ex at other times is to really concentrate on what you see. I actually recommend people do drawing, observational drawing, so they really concentrate on something else. It's not like, oh, I'm not going to think of the elephant, because then you'll think of the elephant, but I'm really going to work out what this pair of glasses looks like, and I'm going to try and draw them. So or notice what you can see or what you can smell, you know, just go to your senses. Leave your mind and go to your senses. You have to train your mind out of obsession. And this sort of like, okay, you can obsess between 5 and 5:30 is a really good idea. And I've seen this work time and time again. It's so freeing when I can get people not to obsess about something they can't do anything about.
Okay. We leave the interview with that last tip. Philippa, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And I'm sorry that I was late. Blame
Don't
my
worry.
Computer.
Don't worry. Yes. Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And thank you very much. And
my
I
pleasure.
Hope everybody buys my book. And then they'll be much happier. It'd be great.
It's okay. Brilliant. So thank you so much. It's been lovely to talking to you. Thank you, Philippa.
Okay.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Don't forget that all the notes for this interview are in my web, cristinamitre.com. Also, if you don't want to miss an episode, subscribe to the Cristina Mitre podcast on your regular podcast player. And one last favor, if you listen to me on Apple Podcasts, give me a few stars and leave a review. That way, you will help this podcast to continue growing. Thank you very much. You will be hearing from me again next Sunday. We'll be right back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.